Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Isaiah chapter 46, which I will entitle Cyrus Rescues the Jews from the Babylonians. This is a short chapter and just an easy chapter too, so we should be done fairly quickly. We start now with verses 1 and 2 of Isaiah 46. Isaiah says this, Bel bows down, Nebo stoops low. Their idols are borne by beasts of burden. The images that are carried about are burdensome, a burden for the weary. They stoop and bow down together. Unable to rescue the burden, they themselves go off into captivity. Now in verse 1, Isaiah mentions two Babylonian gods. The first is Bel. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says that Bel is the same as the Phoenician Baal, B-A-A-L, the famous Baal, that is Lord, Baal means Lord, the chief god of Babylon. To it was dedicated the celebrated Tower of Babylon in the center of one of the two parts into which the city was divided, the palace being in the center of the other, identical with the sun, worshipped on turrets, housetops, and other high places so as to be nearer the heavenly host. Jacinius identifies Bel with the planet Jupiter, which, with the planet Venus under the name Astarte or Astaroth, was worshipped in the east as the god of fortune, the most propitious star to be born under. Well, we'll just remember Bel as the chief idol of the Babylonians. Well, Bel's bowing down to Yahweh. Nebo stoops low, also bowing down to Yahweh. Now, who is this Nebo? Let me tell you what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say first. The planet Mercury or Hermes in astrology, the scribe of heaven answering to the Egyptian Anubis. The extensive worship of it is shown by the many proper names compounded of it. Nebuchadnezzar, see the Nebo there in the first part of Nebuchadnezzar's name. Nebuzaradan, Nabonassar. Answers.com says this, Nebo is the Hebraized form of the Akkadian divine name Nabu. Sometime after 1000 B.C., Nabu, the son of Marduk, the patron god of Babylon, became the patron deity of Babylon's sister city, Borsippa. It is the close association of those two deities in the later Babylonian pantheon that accounts for their appearance together in Isaiah's oracle against Babylon. Bel, i.e. an epithet of Marduk, in other words, Bel is just another name for Marduk, Bel bows down, Nebo stoops. So Marduk of Bel had a son named Nebo, and those two gods were the two chief gods of Babylon. So it's very easy to identify what this chapter is about, the destruction of Babylon. The idols of Bel and Nebo are said in verse 1 to be borne by beasts of burden. The their idols means the Babylonians' idols, namely Bel and Nebo, are put on donkeys or whatever beast they use. They are a burdensome load for the donkeys, a burden for the weary. Now we have a translation problem here. In verse 2, they, meaning the idols of Bel and Nebo, stoop and bow down together, unable to rescue the burden. What in the world does rescue the burden mean? Now this is the NIV translation, which is noted for being a translation so that ninth grade Americans can read it, but I can't understand what that means. And it's ironic, the King James Version, which is almost opaque to me in many, many passages, is very easy to understand. Isaiah 46:1 in the KJV says, Bel boweth down, Nebo stoopeth. Their idols were upon the beast and upon the cattle. Your carriages were heavy loaden. They are a burden to the weary beast. So in other words, the idols are heavy on the backs of the donkeys. Now let's look at some other translations. In the New American Bible, Bel bows down, Nebo stoops. Their idols are upon beast and cattle. They must be borne up on shoulders, carried as burdens by the weary. Now that translation has the Babylonians are weary because they have to carry their idols on the shoulder. The NASB says this, Bel has bowed down, Nebo stoops over, their images are consigned to the beast and the cattle. The things that you carry are burdensome, a load for the weary beast. So in the New American Standard Bible's version of the story here, the idols are not carried by the Babylonians, they are carried by the Babylonians' beast, and they make those beasts weary. Now, the NASB has beast in italics, a load for the weary, italicized beast. That means beast is not in the original Hebrew. The Young's Literal Translation says, Their idols have been for the beast and for cattle, your burdens are loaded, a burden to the weary. they leave beast out because it's not in the original Hebrew, but they do interpret it as saying the idols are on the beasts that are carrying the idols, not on the shoulders of the Babylonians. The American Standard Version says, Baal boweth down, Nebo stoopeth, their idols are upon the beast and upon the cattle, the things that ye carried about are made a load, a burden to the weary beast. So the ASV says the poor donkeys and cows are getting tired carrying the idols. The Bible in Basic English says, their images are on the beast and on the cattle. The things which you took about have become a weight to the tired beast. And the King James says that the idols are a burden to the beast. So the majority of the translations say that these idols are a burden to the beast. Now, if you want to look at the NIV translation, you could say, well, that means the Babylonians are unable to rescue the beast from their heavy burden of the idols because the Babylonians, they themselves, are going off into captivity. But that's just a little dark to me. I think it's just as easy to say that these idols are a burden to the beast and be done with it. And of course, the idea is an idol is absolutely worthless. And here you are loading your animals down with idols that are absolutely worthless. You're wearing your animals out for nothing. We go now to Isaiah 46, verses 3 through 4. And now Yahweh speaks through the mouth of Isaiah. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, all you who remain of the house of Israel, you whom I have upheld since you were conceived and have carried since your birth, even to your old age and gray hairs, I am he. I am he who will sustain you. I have made you, and I will carry you. I will sustain you, and I will rescue you. And of course, what God is talking about here, he's going to rescue the Jews from the Babylonians, and he's going to use Cyrus the Persian to do it. Cyrus delivered them when he gave the decree to go back to Jerusalem in 538 after he had blasted the Babylonians into oblivion in 539 B.C. Now, in verse 3, Yahweh addresses Jacob. And in parallel to that is the house of Israel. That's because Jacob and Israel are two different names for Israel, for Jacob. Just like the individual who gave his name, the patriarch who gave his name to Israel, he had two names too. Jacob Deceiver and Israel wrestles with God because he wrestled with the angel of Jehovah, probably Jesus, at the river Jabbok. Yahweh is said to have carried Israel since their birth, just like a mama carries her baby around on her hip or on her back, depending on her culture. God's carrying Israel around, even to Israel's old age. He sustains Israel. That's a little bit different than a parent. I have made you, and I will carry you. I will sustain you, and I will rescue you. That all is in contradistinction to the idols. They can't carry their worshipers from birth. They can't sustain their worshipers until old age. In fact, they themselves had to be carried by tired donkeys and beasts and cows. We go now to Isaiah 46, verses 5 through 11. Yahweh continues speaking through the mouth of Isaiah. To whom will you compare me or count me equal? The you there is the Jews. To whom will you Jews compare me or count me equal? To whom will you liken me that we may be compared? Some pour out gold from their bags and weigh out silver on the scales. They hire a goldsmith to make it into a god, and they bow down and worship it. They lift it to their shoulders and carry it. They set it up in its place, and there it stands. From that spot it cannot move. Though one cries out to it, it does not answer. It cannot save him from his troubles. Remember this, fix it in mind, take it to heart, you rebels. Remember the former things, those of long ago. I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is none like me. I make known the end from the beginning, from ancient times what is still to come. I say, my purpose will stand, and I will do all that I please. From the east I summon a bird of prey, from a far-off land, a man to fulfill my purpose. What I have said, that will I bring about. What I have planned, that will I do. Good verses for Calvinists who emphasize the sovereignty of God to repeat. Now in verse 6, Yahweh says that some pour out gold and weigh out silver on the scales to make gold idols and to make silver idols. One who makes a silver idol is a little less devoted to idolatry than the ones who use gold to make their idols, but the one weighing out the silver is a little bit more devoted to money than to the idol. But those are typical materials to make idols with. In verse 7, Yahweh says the idol makers lift to their shoulders and carry the idol, as in a procession. Reminds me of Lourdes one time. I was in Lourdes, that famous Catholic place that's noted for miraculous healing in the south of France. and some Catholic priest in some scarlet or purple lavender robe, with a ciborium, that vessel in which the Catholic priest holds the body and blood of Christ, in some kind of a receptacle, and they hold it above their head, and they start walking down the street, and there was a huge crowd there, and my wife and I are standing in the crowd, and all of a sudden, when that host got near us, just like grains of wheat in a hurricane, everybody just planted their faces in the ground, bowed down. That priest was carrying an idol, and they were worshiping that idol. They said it was Jesus, but no, it wasn't. It was bread and wine, and they were worshiping in it. And my wife and I stood out like nails that had not been hammered down. I was very uneasy and felt very awkward about that, but I'm not going to bow down to an idol. Processions. Idolaters love processions. After the procession in verse 7, the idolaters set up the idol in its place. So that could be in a private house. It could be in a temple. But wherever it is, it cannot move from there. Why? Because it's a stupid, dumb piece of wood or gold or silver. It can't move. Though one cries out to it, it does not answer. It cannot save him from his troubles. That's typically why people had idols, is they were constantly in trouble because this is a hard life that we live. And so God says in verse 8, fix this in your mind, you rebels, talking to the Jews, you rebels. Now, some people say that perhaps Isaiah is here talking to the Babylonians, and it could be. But the reason the Jews were in captivity to start with was because they were rebels. And then in verse 9, God says, remember the former things, you rebels. So I'm assuming these are the Jews that God is talking to. What are the former things? John Gill mentions a few, creation of the heavens and the earth and all things in them, the destruction of the old world and of Sodom and Gomorrah. The destruction of the old world would be Noah's flood. The bringing of Israel out of Egypt through the Red Sea and wilderness to Canaan's land and the wondrous things done for them. Remember all that. Remember what God has done. And you have to realize if God does that, there's no other God besides Yahweh. He's no local deity. Verse 10, Isaiah says, or Isaiah has Yahweh saying, I'll make known the end from the beginning. Why is that? Because God is outside of time. He knows the beginning and end. In fact, he has established the future. He's not waiting around to see what happens, as the open theists say. He knows what happened, which is tantamount to saying he made it happen. Well, what are the things still to come from Isaiah's time? John Gill gives some examples. Captivity of the Jews and their return from it. Also the incarnation of Christ, his obedience and sufferings, and the glory that should follow, his resurrection, ascension, and session at the right hand of God, the work of redemption by him, the effusion of the Spirit, the spread of the gospel among the Gentiles and their conversion, and others which are now not yet done, as the conversion of the Jews in the latter day. And of course, the thing that was still to come from the Jews' point of view was their deliverance from Babylon, the return. So at the end of verse 10, God says, my purpose will stand and I will do all that I please. Nobody tells God what to do. There's a lot of things that if I were running the universe, I would have differently. I really would, because of all the evil and stupidity that's in the world. But God has got it all under control, and he'll do what he pleases. He allows evil because he allows man his free will to be idiots and sinners. But because of his grace and his mercy, he withholds the condign punishment from landing on our heads. We have to let God decide how he's going to take care of that. He does all that he pleases. Now here's one thing that he's going to do that he pleases. In verse 11, from the east, I, Yahweh, summon a bird of prey. Now who is this bird of prey? Well, I'm happy to report that all of the commentators, except maybe one, all of my commentators say that this bird of prey is Cyrus. John Gill, Albert Barnes, Joseph Benson, the Cambridge Commentary, Ellicott, Colin Delitzsch, Poole, and the Pulpit Commentary. Now here's what John Gill says about this bird of prey coming from the east. A bird of prey is, quote, always swift in all his expeditions and always recommended celerity in dispatch of business to his soldiers and others. In other words, Cyrus was swift in all his expeditions. As Xenophon often observes, Xenophon is the ancient Greek military man and historian. And very remarkable is that speech of Tigranes to him. Tigranes is a king of Armenia, in which Tigranes tells Cyrus that he so far exceeded the king of Armenia in swiftness that Cyrus came upon Tigranes with a great army from a far country before Tigranes could get his army together, which was just by, and very observable are the words of Cyrus himself, who was desirous of being a thorough horseman, that he might seem to be a winged or flying man. Now the pulpit commentator says that from Cyrus on, the Persians used a golden eagle for their standard, but that same commentary says that's not why Isaiah said the man from the east was a bird of prey. John Gill says that the bird of prey, the word used for that, does not so much denote rapaciousness as swiftness. I don't know about that, but I suspect that Cyrus was both swift and he was rapacious. Now, there is a small minority view that says that this bird of prey that comes from the east to fulfill God's purpose is not Cyrus, but is rather Nebuchadnezzar. Not Cyrus to deliver the Jews, but Nebuchadnezzar to enslave the Jews. Now, in favor of that view, Nebuchadnezzar is called an eagle elsewhere in Scripture. For example, in Jeremiah 49, verse 22, first part of the verse, "Look, it will be like an eagle soaring upward, then swooping down and spreading its wings over Bozra." That's Jeremiah's prediction that Babylonia is going to wipe out Edom. Ezekiel 17:3, "You are to say, this is what the Lord God says, a great eagle with great wings, long pinions, and full plumage of many colors came to Lebanon and took the top of the cedar." That again is Babylon. Well, I just think that's a coincidence. Nice metaphor to use to talk about rapacious kings from the east. We're talking about Cyrus here. He's coming. He's coming to fulfill God's purpose, verse 11. And God says, what I have said, I will bring it about. He said it through Isaiah. He's going to bring it about through Cyrus. What I have planned, God says, that will I do. We now go to the last two verses in Isaiah 46, verses 12 and 13, and we will be finished with this chapter. Yahweh says to somebody, either the Babylonians and Jews, we'll look at that in just a minute, "Listen to me, you stubborn-hearted, you who are far from righteousness. I am bringing my righteousness near. It is not far away, and my salvation will not be delayed. I will grant salvation to Zion, my splendor to Israel." Zion, of course, is the common metaphor, the common synecdoche, the part for the whole. Zion is a mountain, stands for all of the nation of Israel. Now, who are these stubborn-hearted that Yahweh is addressing? Adam Clark says it's the Babylonians, and Poole suggests the Babylonians as an option. Well, that would fit. Listen to me, you stubborn-hearted Babylonians, you who are far from righteousness. You're going down. My righteousness is near. In other words, Cyrus, that's God's righteousness. He's coming. It's not far away. He's going to take you down. That's reasonable. But on the other hand, it could be referring to the Jews that God is speaking to. John Gill, the pulpit commentator, Albert Barnes, and Poole optionally, as an option, say that this verse, verse 12, is referring to the Jews. Backing that up is the fact that Isaiah uses similar words speaking to the Jews in verse 3 of this very same chapter, chapter 46. I'll read that now. God says to the Jews, "Listen to me, house of Jacob," that's the Jews, "listen to me, house of Jacob, all the remnant of the house of Israel," the remnant being the last two tribes, "listen to me, who have been sustained from the womb, carried along since birth." So I tend to believe that God is speaking to the Jews here and calls them stubborn-hearted. After all, that's why they got carried off into exile. "You are far from righteousness." That sounds like the Jews to me. But in verse 13, God says, "I am bringing my righteousness near." And then he says, "My salvation will not be delayed." How is God going to effect salvation? He's going to deliver the Jews from the Babylonian exile. Now, John Gill, of course, refers that directly to Christ and his salvation and his righteousness, but I don't think that's what Isaiah was talking about here. He was talking about deliverance from Cyrus. Albert Barnes says that here the word righteousness evidently denotes God's truth, the fulfillment of his promises. Doesn't mean that Cyrus himself was righteous. He was a pagan. And so once again, we see the mercy of God. He takes a stubborn-hearted people, the Jews, and he delivers them for his purposes, what he wants to do. What he has said, he will do it. "I will do all that I please," he says. And he wants to have the Jews reestablished. Why? So that the Messiah can be born there, Jesus. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Isaiah chapter 46, and we are prepared to go now to Isaiah 47, which I will call the humiliation of Babylon. I hope to see you in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.